and welcome back to Uniquely Genetics, a podcast by Sheep Genetics. I'm Chloe Bunter, and today for our second episode, we will continue our look back through the history of sheep genetics and the genetics evaluation. We're joined today by a very exciting guest, someone who is one of the leading meat scientists within Australia and was there at the very beginning of the sheep genetics story as the land plan officer. He then went on to be the manager of sheep genetics and had other manager roles within Meat and Livestock Australia relating to the adoption and extension of the research and technology. I'm talking about, of course, Alex Ball. Alex is going to take us through those early years of sheep genetics and some of the changes that occurred fairly early on in this history that has had a lasting impact on the evaluation. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alex. I was wondering if you could give us a summary of your background and some of the many hats that you've worn in the industry.
Oh, that's a good question, Chloe. So many years ago, I completed a PhD at the University of New England. So first started looking at sheep genetics with regards to the Medilink program that was running at the time. Then took a 12-month contract to go into MLA or into the MRC at that stage to help Rob Banks out with the Land Plan Development Officer. 19 years later, I left MLA as the general manager of Red Meat Innovation. So I had a fairly long career in MLA. Yeah. And since then, I've been doing private consultancy, mainly working for a whole range of RDCs and looking at a whole range of projects. Nowadays, do a lot of work in environmental sustainability, but still do some work in carcass development and genetics and other components. And yeah, thoroughly enjoying life at the moment, which is good.
Last episode with Rob Banks, we heard about the beginnings of Land Plan and the research that sat behind that. Today, we're going to delve a little bit more into those first few years of sheep genetics, which was known as Sheep Genetics Australia then. Can you take us back to those early days and sort of help us with what some of the defining factors of that time were?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, at the time, Rob may have explained, we'd gone through a major transition with Land Plan. So we'd introduced firstly a cross block. So My first day was the day we actually introduced billing and we also introduced a cross block. So There's some major changes there that happened at the time. And we actually, probably what we didn't find and we didn't do well at the time was some of the change management. So we had breeders out there that were used to getting within flock data, they're used to getting blue dots, red dots and green dots, and therefore 25% of their rams were in the top percentage of their sales. Now, with the cross block, we actually found that some breeders actually had all blue dot rams, so all in the top 25%, and other breeders all had all no dot rams. So, And that was really controversial and created a lot of angst and those type of things. So we went through a cross block and we started that process, and then we did a lot of work with the cross breed at the time as well, starting to compare polled horses with white Suffolks and other areas. Luckily, we had two really major changes that happened at that time. So firstly, we were really lucky. We had this ram called 411, so Medilink 411, and he sort of epitomised everything that breeders didn't really want to see in an animal. So he was short, dumpy, fat, didn't really grow that well and everything like that. But he had fantastic carcass traits and really good birth weight and other traits. And he came out of the Medilink program and was probably carrying the Carvel gene at the time, which is a major gene for muscling. So had all these breeders that were using this ram and not finding any joy in that area. Some other rams that came out at the same time certainly went against what was happening in the show ring and those type of other areas. And then luckily this ram 211 came out. So Carole 211, I still remember his 16 digit ID. So 16-2368, 1998-980211. So that was pretty interesting sheep in that he was used as a ram lamb, so by the time he was getting really good data on board, he actually won five or six shows, including three of the royal shows. And he actually changed the mindset because you could start to see breeders identify they could breed, visually attractive sheep with, really good performance results. So that was all going really well. We were doing Land Plan really well. And it was at a lamb development day, and we're sitting down and trying to map out the future of the sheep industry, and we worked out that 70% of the genetics of the lamb industry came from the merino. So here we were trying to change carcass traits and get our higher growth rates, higher muscling, better yields, starting to continue to take fat down, improve birth weight, try and get a little bit of a handle on worm resistance, and we weren't doing anything with the merino industry. I had a couple of merino breeders who were really keen on that area. We weren't really doing much. So we launched the Merino Validation Project and the Merino and Merino Genetic Services at the time. And basically those two platforms allowed us to get into the merino industry. And that was the catalyst of getting engaged with, you know, a larger proportion of the industry, and it really made a lot of change. The other thing, so here we are starting to do some work in merinos, and, you know, we bought some disparate groups on board. So we had, you know, some of the really strong measurement components with some of the very strong traditional show ring components with some of the SRS breeders, and it was like oil and water, put them all together in one melting pot and then try and tell them that we wanted to create a single database for the merino industry. At the time, which was problematic because we had some really good services operated by CSIRO with Select, mm-hmm. and Andrew Swan was in charge of that at the time. We had some really good services operated by New South Wales DPI, who were running our Landplan software at the time, and they had Merino Benchmark, and we had Merino Genetic Services. So the genesis of Sheep Genetics Australia was that let's combine all of that into one resource, have one single platform for genetic evaluation, and have one group responsible for doing, if you like, the genetic development of the sheep industry. Now, it sounds like a great idea. Complete, you know, there was utter chaos for about 2 or 3 years. So we were trying to put AWI together with MLA, which was, you know, really problematic. We were trying to put merinos together with Landplan people, and Landplan people are saying, well, why are you interested in merinos? You know, you're doing a great job, just focus on us. And, you know, the merino people are saying, well, you know, we want more out of these services. So it was just a really tumultuous time, and we had some, you know, some big personalities involved, and still wear a couple of the scars associated with some of those meetings, but we got through that period, and we combined the databases, the three merino databases, and did the first across block for merinos under the new umbrella Merino Select. Mm-hmm. So we were there, and then we're sitting down there trying to work out how to protect the future of the sheep industry. And over one night, I actually came up with the term ASBV, so Australian Sheep Breeding Values, and trademarked them. So that allowed us to sort of get a bit more of a footprint in the sheep industry. So a bit of a change, and a little bit of a funny story about Sheep Genetics Australia. So we went through, we did all the logos, we did all the branding, we had all our shirts printed up, we had all our jumpers printed up, and then suddenly someone worked out in Genetics Australia, which is a good company that provides services to the beef and the dairy industry, that Sheep Genetics Australia was too close to Genetics Australia. So overnight we had to apply and get a new term up, and so we simply dropped Australia off and became Sheep Genetics. So that's how Sheep Genetics got its name. Nothing adventurous or exciting or anything like that. It was just drop the Australia off and everybody at the patents office was really happy.
Yeah, there you go. As you said, you're essentially trying to create, establish, and set up for longevity in a genetic valuation that had never been done before. And there was confusion and concerns from the industry. What would you say were the most common challenges that you faced with that?
Oh, some really interesting challenges. So we had, you know, breeders who were used to getting within flock and across flock, even mm-hmm. in the merino industry, and suddenly they were being benchmarked against each other. So there's a lot of change management associated with that. We had some scanners out there who were doing great jobs, and they were suddenly scanning merinos. So we had a whole heap of information coming in.
Yeah.
And I remember Daniel Brown and I went to an SRS conference in Wagga the first time, and turned up there, we lost all our luggage and we had our Qantas T-shirts on. So, yeah, the white T-shirts, and it was quite funny, but middle of Wagga, middle of winter, and Qantas gave us a T-shirt to wear for the next day and everything. And we sort of spoke to a lot of people about, you know, what do they want to see. And the merino breeders were really happy with their wool traits and those type of things, but they wanted to see the carcass traits, and they wanted to see worm resistance, and they wanted to see birth weight and a few other areas coming on board. So, yeah, we put that all together. The other big learning experience that came out around about that time is that we were trying to push genetic change down through breeders and through breeders to the commercial industry. So we were using breeders as the conduit to the large commercial industry and the large commercial, if you like, network of producers that produce lamb and sheep meat across Australia. And at that time, we worked out very quickly that that push mechanism was really difficult. And we started doing some work with the likes of Dale Cameron from Tatiara Meats, which is now JBS, and also with Theo Castricum with Castricums, and other guys in Western Australia with Alan Jarman. And we started working with processors, and suddenly worked out that rather than talk to one or two breeders and try and talk to five or six producers, we could get, you know, Theo Kasricum and Dale Cameron, and they could talk to a couple of hundred producers at the same time. So,
yeah,
you know, that worked really well, and we did a whole host of workshops and field days that came through that environment, and that certainly, you know, stimulated a lot more interest in genetic change for us at the time, which is good. So the other major change coming on board is we went from having, as I said, we went from having runs conducted by the scanners, so there was real-time information, to runs that were across flock and across breed. And you know, Stephen Field at the time, we were running the first database with New South Wales DPI with their system. And then we went to Ovis and we ran the across flock and across breed. And it took, you know, a week or so to get the results out, and they happened every month. So everybody was waiting on them. So there was this timing issue, and, you know, everybody tried to get their results in. And then we, you know, we just had to go through a cultural change of getting people much more aware of breeding values. And we still had hiccups, you know, we still had rams coming to the top and you wondered why, and had really good rams which were winning shows and just weren't doing anything. And you know, that happened more and more in the merino industry as well as in the terminal and the maternal industry. And you know, but it was good times. And we actually had the lamb development network and the lamb advisory group, and we also had the whole consultancy group across the broad range of state DPIs at the time, and it was a great network of people to be really engaged, and genetics was at the forefront of that. So we started to see carcass weights lift, and we started to see, you know, fat improve and yield improve, and then we went into the sheep CRC, and that's the next story.
Yeah, absolutely. We sort of take it for granted now that it is a multi-breed evaluation, but in those early days you would have come across some real resistance.
Absolutely. And you know, trying to get merino breeders to say that the traditional breeders would be compared with the measurement performance breeders would be compared with SRS breeders. Well, that was really difficult at the time. And you know, then we had sires that were in, you know, the equivalent of the Australian merino sire evaluation versus sires which were just within flocks. So people were trying to work out, are they comparable and those type of things. We put polled horses with white suffix, with texels, with dorpers, and tried to say that that all can be compared and everything like that. And then I think we did something really adventurous. We tried to compare Coopworths and Corridales and Border Leicesters, and everybody thought that was a bit strange. But, you know, we had the resource block at the time and the sheep information nucleus, and we're starting to get some really good handles on what crossbreed breeding values are actually doing. And, you know, by and large, some really good rams came out at the time, and that, you know, propelled or really forced a whole gamut of change with regards to the sheep industry. So, you know, at the time when we first did the first across flock, I can remember a +4 for growth rate for, and at that time we were using yearling weight. We weren't using post-weaning weight, weren't using weaning weight.
Yeah, wow.
So +4 for yearling weight was unheard of. And then, you know, a little bit of work I'd done in my own PhD suggested we should move back to post-weaning weight and yearling weight, focus on early growth and do a few things like that. And then, you know, suddenly we were finding these +6s and +8s and +10s and +12s. And I think nowadays, if you're not above a 20, you're sort of not in the right ballpark. And, you know, we started to do a lot of work with birth weights. So, you know, I had this graph I put up earlier on in a forum where literally it was birth weight versus post-weaning weight. And there was some high birth weight rams, and I put a knife on that quadrant and said, this is the best thing you can do with these rams. Well, I didn't know at the time, but one breeder had about 8 rams in that particular quadrant. He wasn't real happy with me at the time. So it was a lot of fun. Then, yeah, we went down to the big forums. We had the young sire programs were in full force, so Meat Elite and the White Suffolk Young Sire program, the Texel Young Sire program. Super Borders were going really well. So, yeah, we had a lot of really strong advocates on our side. But I remember going to the White Suffolk conferences, and a third of the people loved to see you there. A third of the people didn't know why you were there, and a third of the people didn't want you there. So, you know, it was a great time, and, you know, really good and challenging environment. And at the time, we also had MLAs. So to get the funding required for some of the work we're doing was really problematic, because you had to go through the MLA network. And, you know, there were 9 really senior program managers and a couple of really great general managers in Ian Johnson and Ruben Rose. And to get funding for genetics, you had to put, you know, everything on the table and compete with other funding for pastures or whatever it may well be. So, you know, there were some heady times, and a lot of people said, you know, there were bloodbaths and those type of things. It was just really good times, and genetics was at the forefront. So that was good. And the next thing that came out was the whole range of forums that we had with Primetime and New Time and bounce back for Marinos and that, where genetics was at a key linchpin for a lot of those talks, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. All this that's built on and continued in some form today. Let's skip forward a bit to when genomics first came into the picture. Oh. It's now used for pedigree, earlier selection accuracy, and again, is something that's kind of taken for granted when it comes to the calculation of ASPVs and those hard-to-measure traits like reproduction and eating quality. But what was it like when it was first being considered as an option? What timeline are we looking at? And did you ever imagine it play as large of a role in the modern genetics industry as it has?
Not at all. So we started, and I'll get my timing right, it was about 2001, 2002, we started to plan the sheep genomics resource population, the sheep genomics resource blocks. And so that was done with AWI. It was done at the Faulkner Field Station. And we started to say, you know, can we look for these major genes? And at the time, we were hoping to find five or six genes that influence sheep production, and we're spending $400 to $500 an animal to get them phenotyped, and about another $200 or $300 an animal to get them genotyped, and putting together this population. And that was sort of the catalyst of the information nucleus as well. But we did all of this work down at Faulkner, and we got, you know, really good results coming out of that. And then halfway through that program, we started to work out that rather than having one or two genes, we could probably do 1,000 genes, or, you know, or at least 1,000 markers or 2,000 markers. And by the end of that, we had the 50K chip or the 50,000 marker chip, and we were starting to see that we could do some genomic breeding values, but then how do you put them together with our traditional breeding values? So we went through a whole range of blending and looking at what the beef industry was doing, the dairy industry doing, what the world's sheep populations were doing. Had our first blended breeding values out, and you know, it was really difficult because breeders, they sort of had come to the acceptance that what they were measuring could be combined into a if you like, a national platform for genetic evaluation. So that was the phenotypes. And now we were throwing genotypes at them and saying, well, by the way, you can combine all these and you can combine that into a single breeding value. Well, you know, there are animals that were coming up that did not look like they had any of the genes that associated. And the big challenge is, you know, we were starting to work with IMF and shear force and some of those other traits that you physically cannot see. You can only get from, you know, doing really good progeny tests and putting them through and getting those hard to measure traits. Now, we were producing these and putting them out into a range, you know, range of breeding values for a global population. And there were animals that were coming up with IMF. I remember Hampshire Down, in the information flock, resource flock or information nucleus flock, he topped the charts for IMF. Well, everybody thought that was wrong. You know, how could that be? And then the next year, we started to learn that Merinos could have really good IMF because they're, you know, finished a bit later and, you know, those type of things. And so people just didn't believe that, you know, the best of the Pearl Dorsets were having average IMF and the best of the Merinos were, you know, excelling in IMF. And that's still, you know, still the case today that there's still a whole host of variation. And that was the other thing that, that we still have learnt, that the variation within a breed is greater than the variation between breeds and definitely the variation across the population. So, yeah, and that's still what I talk to SRS breeders today when, or other breeders I interface with them and say, there's a whole kaleidoscope of opportunity out there. You just got to find the right rams to use at the right time.
Absolutely. That variation within a breed, across a flock and between flocks is really still important to the analysis. What did genomics mean for the resource flock and the young sire programs that were happening at the time?
Well, it was, well, we started to get, firstly, we started to get accuracies on young sires that only would be seen when we had, you know, progeny in the system. So suddenly we could use younger sires with a lot more confidence. We started to pull those young sires apart a lot more. So, you know, the traditional genetic models, two ET brothers, for example, had very similar genetics. You know, half-sibs had very similar genetics. Suddenly we were pulling apart with genomics and, you know, people saying, well, how can these half-brothers be, you know, so different? Or how can these, you know, full ET sibs be so different in their genetics? And so people are starting to use that a lot more. I don't think, even today, the breeders are fully aware that genomics is the best tool for pulling apart genetic evaluation systems. And, you know, I still encourage people, if they're not doing really effective and efficient genomic evaluation platforms within their own breeding program, they should be, because it allows you to pull apart genetic evaluation much more succinctly and much more efficiently. And so we did that with the Young Sire program, started to use that more, started to use a bit more inbreeding, started pulling rams in, and you know, we could pull rams in that had no breeding values at all, genomically test them, and suddenly they had breeding values that you could utilize. And we did that in the Young Sire programs and a couple of other areas. So, and we brought in rams into the information nucleus that you would never have considered using simply because they had really good genotypes, and suddenly their progeny started to perform as we did. There was one particular ram that was, yeah, he was small. He wasn't a merino ram. He was small. He wasn't great. Didn't look great. Came out of a Western Australian flock. Most people were really suspicious about why has he got these good breeding values. Put him into the information nucleus, and I think he had in the merino evaluation 15 out of the top 20 animals for post-weaning weight and yearling weight were by that particular ram. I mean, he was 2 or 3 kilos above everything else. So, you know, people started to sit up and say, well, maybe we should take a bit more notice of this genetics. But, you know, we had 11 kilo birth weights in the information nucleus that no one had ever seen before. You know, we had 8 kilo triplets. Yeah, and we started to say, well, this birth weight's different. We had worm resistance. So, you know, there were big challenges with the monkers, but also with a lot of the worms. And we started to find, you know, rams whose progeny had zeros to tens to 20s and other rams whose progeny had 20 to 30,000 in the same group. And, you know, that was the other big thing. We could take rams out of environments in South Australia where worms were never measured, put them into a genomic evaluation system and suddenly work out whether their genetics would be applicable for a high worm environment such as the New England or Tasmania or Kangaroo Island. So, yeah, changed how people view access to genetics.
Yeah, absolutely, and really test those animals in different environments.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, you know, the best breeders nowadays are people who still have, you know, really good measurement systems, really well-defined management groups, and that's the other thing. You know, people say genomics takes away the sophistication of breeding. It doesn't. You know, people still need really good, well-managed, well-structured management groups with good sire evaluation systems within those. And really good measurements, and those measurements then underpin some of the really strong genomic evaluations we get out today. So, you know, genomics is just another tool that enhances our ability to select for genetic change.
Absolutely. What would you say are some of your key learnings or memories from your time at Sheep Genetics?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So, firstly, I think we didn't do people management well. So, with the deepest respect to Rob and myself, we were probably really strong academically, but probably people management wasn't our great strength. And you know, here we were trying to get change management going through, so the theory of change and trying to get people to really embrace differences of opinion and different philosophies. And we had fantastic breeders out there that had been breeding for multi-generations, you know, and inherited their stud from their dad, had inherited their stud from their grandfather, and done a whole hope of change visually, and then we were trying to get genetic evaluation systems into them. So change management, if I would say one thing now that we would do different, we'd do change management very differently. We'd probably bring in the processing sector much more earlier and much more succinctly and work with those. We would have done the big national forums much earlier than what we've done. So, you know, the time we did U-time and those type of things, recovery from drought and those areas, we learned a really valuable process that people, when they come and they see a multifaceted, multi-disciplined approach to information flow, will accept where genetics fits into that area. I still think that's far more powerful than running even individual genetic workshops nowadays, because people get the view that genetics is just one of the tools that enhances their ability to make systems more resilient and make systems more profitable and productive. Another thing, we would have done a better job, I think, of trying to get some of those across flock and across, particularly across breeding value systems in place. Probably would have used PDSs a little bit more succinctly in that, trying to demonstrate change. The information flock, we should have brought that on earlier. That was great. Should have had multi-satellites around the genomics program to do that. And nowadays, I honestly believe we should do more with getting people to do more genomic evaluation. And saying that, you know, use the tools available such as parentage and the fact that you can can enhance your genetic evaluation more by having that genomic evaluation system in place. So, you know, definitely the lambdas a big challenge for Merino breeders, as it is for Pole Dorset and White Suffolk and the, you know, the terminal breeders. If we move to a lambda that's 0.95, for example, which is how much notice you take of the genetic or the genomic information versus how much notice you take of the pedigree information,
mm-hmm.
more days, and nowadays we take much more notice of the genomic information. If we do that, then people have to do genomics if they want to remain competitive. So that's another learning experience. And the other big thing, potentially, we may not have ever put MLA and AWI together and run sheep genetics. And I say that with a bit of hindsight that, you know, we had two culturally very different organisations and they still are quite different. I think it would have been better off having an overarching umbrella of, if you like, investment in genetics coming in from both companies, but letting one of the companies run the genetic evaluation system, because, you know, we definitely had two boards, multiple masters, multiple areas in that place, and, you know, it became difficult to serve those two areas.
You mentioned earlier that you came on in a 12-month contract. Did you ever expect the sheep genetics evaluation to last the 30-plus years that it has?
No. And in fact, after a week, I wondered whether it would last more than 7 days. So, look, I was quite lucky that I'd done a little bit of genetics at uni. I'd sort of knew Rob and Brian Kinghorn and those people. So I fundamentally knew that genetic evaluation was highly important. We went to a cross block and I thought we'd probably stick there. A crossbreed was great. But I think it was Merino Genetic Services and putting together Merino Select with Swanee and people like Kevin Atkins and Alan Casey were great helping that platform out as well. We put that together and for the first time I could actually see that genetic evaluation is a lifetime investment for the industry. And I knew Absolutely. That we would have to have genetic evaluation at any time, simply because for most of the traits, they are heritable. And if they're heritable, they've got a component of genetics. And for some of the key traits like IMF and shear force, where you can't see them, genetics and genomics are the only ways that you can make positive change. And the future of the sheep meat industry will be around things like methane and sustainability and eating quality and, you know, fit for purpose sheep in environments and those type of areas. They are all going to be dominated by genomics. So, in fact, the question or the answer to the question is there's a greater value proposition now for investment in genetic evaluation than there was 10 years ago, simply because the sheep industry will rely on genetic evaluation to answer some of the big community and consumer questions of the future.
Absolutely. You've had a lifetime career in genetics and breeding, working across so many different aspects. What can we look forward to from you?
So I still do a little bit, still help out with some breeders and thoroughly enjoy that. Nowadays I invest or spend a fair bit of time helping out a range of RDCs with evaluations and strategic planning and those type of things. Worked across now 20 or 30 industries, so that's great. Do a little bit of work with MLA and ISC on some of their projects, which still is great because, you know, some really good people in that area, and sit on a couple of boards and that's great because it allows me to look at genetic evaluation. I run my own little Angus stud, so that's a bit of fun. So that's basically for 20 years in MLA, we had this condition, which I still think is very important, that we couldn't compete with any of mm-hmm. our stakeholders that we represented. So that was part of the contracts that I signed. So, you know, having a small Angus stud allows me to look at genomics and genetic evaluation and those type of things in a very much smaller scale, but it's a nice way of looking at it. So nowadays I'm the breeder complaining about when bulls and things go up and down. So I empathise with breeders in that area. But I still like reading a lot on and still read a lot of papers around genetic evaluation and some of the new methane work. Talk to Rob about some of that area. Talk to some of the, you know, the key people. I sit on Datagene, which is the dairy equivalent of Lamplan or sheep genetics. So sit on its board now, and they're great people. So I'm really enjoying trying to look at the dairy industry and what it can do. And, you know, ultimately, I think there's a need for having one single national evaluation platform for all of livestock across Australia. And that may be something in the future that could come about. So, yeah, still thoroughly enjoying it. And the best of the thing is I get to talk to some really great breeders that want to talk to me, which is different to where we were 20 years ago, where I had to talk to breeders that probably weren't enthusiastic, but nowadays still have that. And we had, we had a lot of nicknames for different breeders. So the breeders who might listen to this, so we had, the Shaggies and the Jackals and the Coyotes and all this, which is sort of the code that we developed for making sure that we could talk about breeders without actually identifying who they were. And they soon pretty much worked out that code. And then had the two doctors. So we had the equivalent of a podcast, but it was our email. And we had the, breeders could send in email questions and the two doctors would answer these questions. And people never worked out that the two doctors were Rob and myself. So that was a bit of fun. And Stephen was the moderator. So that was like, and then, we actually had some really good tools that we got out there. And luckily, there's been some great people I've interfaced with. And even though, there are still people today that would have differences of opinion, it still enabled you to form some great relationships. And
absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I have definitely learned a lot about the first couple of years of Sheep Genetics, and I really appreciate your time.
Terrific. Thanks, Chloe. Anytime.